From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we look ahead to the holiday weekend and offer three very different options, starting to the south as we go to Six Flags' enormous new roller coaster. Then, as Pro Beach Volleyball returns to Milwaukee, the sport surges in popularity.
I've got a daughter who's 15, and a lot of her friends are just not really that interested in playing indoors. They want to play it on the beach, so they're really focusing on beach. Maybe they played a year or two of indoor, but now it's all about beach.
And the Stubby Chubbs Band has a couple of concerts this week. We'll hear their scientific process for choosing material.
Our arranging process is sit in a room and figure out what to do. And then
do it. If it doesn't work, then stop doing it.
Yeah. Which we've definitely had our fair share of those, too. Like, well, we played this tune once or twice. Okay. We learned our lesson.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. We're going into the Independence Day weekend, and while your plans might well include a parade, some fireworks viewing, maybe a trip to Summerfest, and a picnic or two, you have three full days to work with. So what could your plans also include? Well, if you have the need for speed, you could head south of the border, the Wisconsin border, that is, to Gurnee, Illinois, home of Six Flags Great America Amusement Park. That's where you'll find a brand new roller coaster, Goliath, that breaks not one, but three world records. It's the fastest wooden coaster with the tallest and steepest drop in the world. It's been online for not quite a month. Our resident David, producer Stephanie Lecce, took on Goliath and lived to tell the tale.
Goliath is an apt description for Six Flags Great America's monstrous new roller coaster. Riders travel to the top of a 165-foot lift hill, then plummet 180 feet at a near-vertical 85-degree angle at a breathtaking 72 miles per hour. Pretty impressive for a wooden roller coaster, but this isn't your grandparents' Cyclone. It's the fastest and tallest wooden coaster in the world. And it's why, even though it's storming out, hundreds of thrill seekers have turned out to take on Goliath, just like Sid Pinabella of Racine.
We actually are waiting to go on it for the first time.
What do you hope it'll be like?
Spectacular. Blow my mind.
What do you think about it being a wooden roller coaster?
That's the classics. So that's one of the best types of roller coasters, I believe. It's the old-fashioned roller coaster with the new technology.
Perhaps that's Goliath's greatest achievement, the melding of new technology with the classic wooden design. Six Flags marketing director John Craniac says riders won't have experienced anything like this before.
They can expect a very extreme ride experience. It is something else. I do believe that this might be the best ride in our park right now. So very extreme. Two inversions on a wooden roller coaster with no shoulder harness. The drop breaks two world's records. It's the tallest and steepest drop on any wooden coaster on the planet, and it is the fastest wooden coaster on the planet at 72 miles an hour. It is a phenomenal ride.
Now, Six Flags has some amazing steel coasters like X-Flight, Raging Bull. Why did Six Flags want to bring in another wooden roller coaster that has these kinds of tricks with it?
Yeah, I think Six Flags... innovation is very important to us, that we want to keep pushing the envelope. We want to take advantage of the new technology out there to keep delivering the best thrills to our guests. So this new technology on these wooden roller coasters just continues to push that envelope and do things that no other wooden roller coaster can. So the opportunity to deliver that, the opportunity to bring that to the park as opposed to the other steel coasters that we have a phenomenal arsenal of steel coasters. This lets us keep moving in that new direction with the wooden coaster. So we took advantage of it, and it delivers. It's fantastic.
What do you think patrons like about wooden roller coasters?
I think the patrons, as far as we hear from our guests, that there is just that different feel about a wooden coaster. It has that classic feel to it. It's got a little bit of that ricketiness to it that is unique. It's different from the steel roller coasters, so it offers a little different type of thrill. So with the wide variety of coasters that are out there, this is just another one in that different type of experience. But this one is smooth. So the technology, this topper track that they use to deliver all these maneuvers, it is a smooth ride.
Well, tell me about where it is in the park and what the challenge was in trying to get it into that space.
Sure. It is right at the back of the park. It is almost immediately as far back as you can get from our front gate. And the challenge getting in that spot is it used to be occupied by the Iron Wolf. And that came out in 2012. So it's been vacant for a couple of years. But the space was as is. You know, it was an existing space. So this group came in, Rocky Mountain Construction, and they designed this roller coaster specifically to sit in the existing space that was there. So it was, you know, they felt that they could deliver this world record-breaking coaster in this kind of small, confined space that they had, and they delivered. It's great.
Now, you're from Wisconsin yourself.
I am. I live in Franklin.
Now, why do you think riders should come down, or potential riders, should come down from Wisconsin to Gurnee, Illinois, to ride Goliath and the other coasters here at Six Flags?
You got to make the trip for the new coaster. This is, again, it's a world record breaker, and we have it right here a few minutes south of the border. So cross that state line, come on down, ride Goliath. It is the time to come. If you haven't been here for a while, we introduced X-Flight in 2012. It was the world's third wing coaster. Again, all new technology from B&M, the Cadillac of coaster manufacturers. So we continue to keep pushing our new rides and the new innovation. And if you haven't been here, it's time to come on down now, at least, if not anything, to ride Goliath. Really, I think if this is the only park that you know, this is our park, this is our local theme park, no other competition anywhere else, we're spoiled. We have one of the best parks in the entire country here, really in the entire world. We have the water park in Hurricane Harbor, 14 roller coasters. My kids are 10, 10, and 9, and they come and ride constantly. I always hear about people asking about, is there enough to do for my kids? Take it from me. I have twin girls that are 10 and a son who's 9, and they just can't get enough of the place. So plenty to do for the family and plenty to do for those thrill seekers, too.
Let me ask you a question. Obviously, Six Flags has both American Eagle as well as the Viper, which are your more traditional wooden roller coasters. How does Goliath compare with those?
It's certainly more extreme because of the record-breaking nature. Just taking a look at Goliath, the drop, the lift hill and the initial drop is supported by a steel structure. So it is very unique looking. And it, again, contributes to the ability to deliver those world's records. The rest of the ride looks like the traditional wooden roller coaster. So kind of a bit of a hybrid in how the structure was designed. What makes it the wooden coaster is the wooden track. So that makes it the wooden roller coaster. I think, if I'm not mistaken, with the Little Dipper, with American Eagle, with Viper, and with Goliath, I believe we have the most wooden coaster track of any theme park in the world. I believe that. I need to confirm my statistics a little bit, but that's my understanding right now. So,
now for yourself, are you a wooden or a steel?
This one might change my opinion. I love the steel coasters. It's because of the maneuvers and the speeds that you can achieve. But now here comes the wooden coasters doing those same things and beating them. This ride is 1 mile an hour slower than Raging Bull. I mean, Raging Bull is almost everybody's favorite ride at this park. This is 1 mile an hour slower. The drop is steeper. It's just incredible what they can do now with this stuff. So this may convert me to wood. I'm not sure.
Now, of course, Six Flags is pretty pumped about its new ride, but how does Goliath stack up against coasters, both wooden and steel, from across the country? Enter the American Coaster Enthusiasts, a group of diehard coaster fans who ride the best of the best rides in the U.S. Lake Villa, Illinois resident Ashley Perkins is a member who rode Goliath several times.
Well, I've never been in an RMC coaster, which a Rocky Mountain Construction coaster. They're new to the industry with roller coaster construction. They do wooden roller coasters, and they have a completely different design on wooden roller coasters in general. So it's super smooth. It's amazing. They've added turns and elements into a wooden roller coaster that you wouldn't get traditionally.
Tell me about that. I mean, what are wooden roller coasters usually like from your experience traveling around the country, and how did Goliath compare?
Well, just the two rides here at just Six Flags Great America, you have the Viper as well as the American Eagle, and they just, you know, it's mainly just hills and turns and just a regular traditional up and down type of ride, you know, a bunch of put your hands up in the air, oh, I'm afraid that I'm going to, you know, get them chopped off and that type of deal. But with this coaster, you know, they've added, you know, a zero-G stall as well as a dive loop. And that's something that you don't really get with traditional wooden roller coasters.
All right, so now let me ask the question that everyone listening wants to know. How was it?
It was amazing. It is a fantastic ride and definitely along the lines of even Raging Bull. And even that smooth. As a wooden roller coaster, you wouldn't expect that at all.
So how does Goliath compare to other big coasters around the country?
It's easily in a top 10. With anybody that would ride it. It's a phenomenal ride, as well as, you know, it even beats out steel coasters, which is something that you wouldn't expect out of a wooden.
So how can you get a wooden roller coaster to do all those tricks and turns? Just ask Fred Grubb, the founder of Rocky Mountain Construction, which designed Goliath.
We developed new ideas in the roller coaster industry. We've developed what we call the iBox and the topper track, which are basically the same technologies. And we have replicated the older version of the existing wood tracks. And what we've done is this allows us to put new tricks, new elements in the wooden roller coaster industry. We're able to go upside down, do barrel rolls, put more forces on the track, do all kinds of things. Actually, we're able to do things that steel roller coasters have only been able to do so far.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that track technology.
What's on this particular coaster is what we call the topper track. So it has a wood stack underneath a rectangular steel tube. So unlike the old versions of the wood track where it's steel plates on top of wood, we pre-build these in sections and haul them to the field and install them. It's just new technology. We have a factory in Hayden, Idaho, of all places, and we produce the track there. We produce everything ourselves, even the cars. We're able to, it's an all-welded version of track. We don't really bend any steel. We just flex it into shape. It's interesting, innovative technology, and we have more to come. But this, with the wood stack, is considered a wooden roller coaster.
And so that allows the coaster to be able to do some of the things that traditionally only steel coasters used to be able to?
That's correct, yes. Steel coasters have been the only coasters to be able to do these things. Now we can do it with a wood coaster. In this coaster, we go upside down. We have what we call a Raven turn, which is a big reverse loop. We have a barrel roll in it. We have overbank corners. We have airtime. We have everything in the coaster. In this small footprint, and it was very tough to fit this all of this coaster in this small footprint.
Why maintain that wood coaster frame, though? Why stick with that instead of just building another steel coaster in order to get some of these tricks?
People are passionate about wood coasters. It's a different ride. People like to ride the wooden coasters. What we've done is we've upped the game. So we've made the wood coasters capable of doing different elements that we couldn't do before.
What's the benefit for a park like Six Flags to have a coaster with this kind of new technology?
Well, the benefit is it creates a great ride for the patrons. It's a great marketing tool. They're some of the best rides in the world. And so obviously, that's why they want them.
Tell us specifically about this ride, Goliath. What's unique about this one?
Well, we have what we call a Raven turn, which is you actually go upside down at the end of the ride and come back within yourself. We go through a barrel roll. We have two overbank corners. We have airtime. We have all the elements packed into this small site.
And this is the tallest wooden coaster in the world?
Yep. And fastest. Yeah. We are breaking records. It's also the steepest drop. So it's exciting. And it runs 72 miles an hour.
What do you like about wooden roller coasters?
Well, I started the company. I'm an adrenaline junkie from the get-go, and I'm passionate about building projects like this. And we used to build all kinds of projects. Now we only do roller coaster work. You know, I've been in the roller coaster industry for 20 years, and we started this company in 2000, developed the product, and it's really taken off. Building roller coasters is much more exciting, much more fun than building square buildings.
So what's next for Rocky Mountain Construction? I mean, how are you going to top this technology?
We have new things to come. I can't tell you about them right now, but we have new ideas. Alan Shilkley, our designer and my partner, we have new ideas to come. We keep topping our, we keep pushing the limits.
I'm assuming you've personally ridden Goliath.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I ride them to test them, and then obviously today I ride it, and it's I don't get tired of it. I like riding them.
And what was it? Give us a little taste, a little preview of what the ride is like.
It is exciting all the way through. It's very smooth. Unlike traditional wooden coasters, this track is very smooth. It allows us to run at these speeds, do what we're doing. It takes your breath away the whole ride. So what we've tried to do is make this ride so that there is no dull time in it. The whole time it's exciting all the way through.
Grubb may call the coaster exciting, but rider Jerry Clark of Pleasant Prairie calls it crazy.
I mean, just look at it. It's crazy, and it added up to being pretty crazy. Oh my God, the first drop is like, it's indescribable. It's crazy. And you're upside down a lot, but it's fast. It's a lot of fun. It's one of the best ones. Every part of it is just a blast. So now we're just trying to get the last seat. We did the front, we did the middle, so now we're going to go for the last and compare. The front is really good, but from what I understand, the back, the last seat is supposed to be one of the best.
With a review like that, I may just have to try this coaster myself, no matter how intimidating it may be. From the top of Goliath, I'm Stephanie Lecce.
Stephanie Lecce took us to Six Flags Great America, where the Goliath roller coaster is taking thrill seekers on a record-breaking descent. In the process, we heard from Fred Grubb, founder of Rocky Mountain Construction, Six Flags marketing director John Craniak, Ashley Perkins of American Coaster Enthusiasts, and Wisconsinites Jerry Clark and Sid Pinavella. You can see a video from Stephanie's ride at wuwm.com/lake effect. We'll make our way back down to the ground for some differently fast-paced action as Pro Beach Volleyball returns to Milwaukee. That segment is next as Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. We're looking ahead to the holiday weekend that's almost upon us. The lakefront will, of course, be a busy place because Summerfest is rolling along through Sunday. But just up the shore, Bradford Beach will be buzzing with volleyball fans. The AVP, that's the National Pro Beach Volleyball Tour, holds its first full event in Milwaukee since the late 90s, today through Sunday. It'll bring world-class players to Milwaukee, including Olympic medal winners like April Ross, Kerry Walsh Jennings, Phil Dahlhauser, and Todd Rogers. Rogers, playing with teammate Dahlhauser, won gold in Beijing in 2008. They came up short a few years later in London. His career dates all the way back to the last pro events held in Milwaukee. He lives in California, but we caught up with him by phone from Indiana, where he was getting ready to coach players at a clinic. Todd Rogers, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you are said to be the only active player on the AVP Tour who played the events in Milwaukee back in 1997 and 98, which was the last time there was a full tour event here. Can you talk about how the sport has changed in 17 years, say?
It has changed quite a bit, actually. The biggest change has actually been on the court itself. The court is smaller. It used to be 9 meters by 9 meters on a side. Now it's 8 meters by 8 meters. You can serve the ball and hit the net and have it trickle over, and that's now good. So there have been some major changes in regards to that. And then, of course, with the advent of social media and everything else that's gone on. The sport has changed a lot in those regards, kind of like everything, I guess, in our lives. But those major changes on the court, and then, of course, some of the ones on the managerial side for the AVP have changed quite a bit. But we're going back to the same spot and really looking forward to seeing how Bradford Beach has held up over the years.
Do you have any memories of those 97 and 98 events?
I do, actually. I actually have one specific memory. It's not actually a good memory, really, but we did well in Milwaukee, I recall. But one of the days, the very last day, actually, on Sunday, it rained. And at the time, I needed to wear glasses to be able to see at a decent enough to be able to play. And it started raining, and I had to take them off. And I remember we got clubbed by a team and ended up losing, I think, taking fourth. And that was actually one of the impetuses behind me getting LASIK and having 20/20 vision now.
So then you don't really have to worry about the weather at all here today or this weekend. But let's talk about things today. A lot of people are here in this country are paying close attention to the World Cup, or at least they were until the U.S. lost to Belgium. What do you see as the state of beach volleyball in the U.S.? Where is our greatest competition coming from today?
Traditionally, Brazil is a very strong beach volleyball power. And in fact, volleyball in general, indoors as well as beach, is probably the second most popular sport in Brazil behind, of course, soccer or football. And then some of the other stronger countries, Germany. Germany has a lot of very good teams. And the tendency around the world is that countries that are strong are the ones that have had some kind of professional tour within their country. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's one of the reasons why we in the USA have been so strong, is that because we've had the AVP for a long time to basically, you know, it's a training ground or a breeding ground for talented beach volleyball players.
Well, and you talk about that. It's interesting. You know, years ago, so many athletes in beach volleyball, I gather, came to it from indoor traditional volleyball. Is that still the case today, or does beach volleyball at this point have so much of a developmental system that there are people who are coming up as beach volleyball players who really have never played the indoor game?
There's a handful of those. I think you're going to see more and more, especially now with the advent of beach or sand volleyball in the NCAA ranks for the women. I think a lot of the girls are going to start playing, and I'm already seeing this actually myself. I've got a daughter who's 15, and a lot of her friends are just kind of not really that interested in playing indoors. They want to play it on the beach, and so they're really focusing on beach. Maybe they played a year or two of indoor, but now it's all about beach. But you do have guys like Phil Dellhauser. He played a tiny bit of indoors, but it really wasn't his thing. His thing was beach volleyball. Same thing with Jake Gibb and Sean Rosenthal. Both of whom were 08 and 012 Olympians. You know, they were, they dabbled in indoors, but really it was all about the beach for them. That's really where they enjoyed the game and really where they learned a lot of their skills and whatnot was at the beach. So more and more so, I think you're seeing a focus on the beach rather than a focus indoor and then the transition to the beach.
What do you think it is that draws people to the beach more so than indoors?
From my perspective, it's funner. you're playing outdoors on the sand. There's two on two, so of course you're maximizing your touches. You know, you're touching the ball every single time the ball comes over on your side, whether that's a pass and a hit or a shot, or whether that's a set. You know, indoors you can go a long rally and never ever touch the ball. So I think a lot of kids and people in general are kind of enjoying that aspect a lot more. I also think it's a very social sport. Volleyball in general is very social, but beach volleyball in particularly so. There's 15, 20, 30 seconds between each rally, and you're able to socialize with your partner or the people across the net from you or even people outside the volleyball court itself. And I think that's really attractive to a lot of people.
There is something about the chemistry between the people that are playing the sport and the crowd that's there. It's really sort of, and I guess I have only seen it on television, but there really seems like part of the attraction to it is how close together the people who are playing, the people who are watching are.
Yeah, you know, you're for the most part, you're right on the sand with the players. So literally, they can be standing right there and there's a banner and then a fan is literally on the other side of the banner within touching distance. And I do think so. I think, you know, when they cheer good plays and you know, they hear a player hears somebody sitting there and screaming and yelling for them or even against them, they kind of get into that and they'll kind of spot them out and give them either the thumbs up or they'll make a good play and kind of like, you know, point to them like, yeah, that's what I thought kind of a thing. And I don't know, there's some kind of fun little aspect of that in beach volleyball that's not always the case in a lot of sports.
You won the gold medal in the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing at age, I think you're 34 or 35. Here you are 6 years later, still playing. How hard is this sport on your body today when you are almost 41 versus when you were younger?
You know, it's interesting. Beach volleyball is, in some ways, very difficult on your body in the sense that you've got to work pretty hard on your muscles and whatnot to be able to move in the sand and jump out of the sand, et cetera. But on the other hand, the sand, I should say, is very forgiving on your joints, your knees, your ankles, your back, your hips, even your shoulder, because you're not always swinging as hard as you can at the ball. You're actually shooting the ball around, so it's a little bit easier on your shoulder. So from that perspective, it's much, much easier than the vast majority of sports, except perhaps water sports. So I think the longevity, as long as you can stay in good shape, keep your muscles strong, you know, lifting and playing on the sand and whatnot, you can play a lot longer than you could in, say, a court sport.
You're not getting planting injuries like when you're trying to pivot in baseball or soccer or whatever.
Exactly. The sand gives out from underneath you, so you never, you know, the cleat isn't grabbing, so to speak, and then something's got to give, and usually that means your ankle or your knee or some catastrophic injury is going to happen. And then just the general pounding. You know, you jump in the sand, you land, and if it's good sand, you've got an automatic cushion right there. Versus on the court, if you're jumping in basketball or volleyball or something like that, when you land, it's going to hurt. And of course, there's no contact involved. So in like football or basketball or something like that, there's no collisions. There very rarely are there collisions.
You don't hear a lot of people talking about the concussion risk in volleyball.
No, it's pretty rare. I mean, really the only, if you hit a standard of some kind or a banner, of course your partner.
Let me ask a potentially dumb question. You play tournaments in Florida and California and the New Jersey Shore and Salt Lake and here in Milwaukee. Can you feel the difference in the sand?
Absolutely. If it's a packed sand or a really deep sand, thick sand, or like, you know, a Florida coast kind of real almost white, super granular type sand, you definitely feel the differences. And mostly it's how high you can jump. You get a little bit more packed sand and you're jumping higher. It's a little bit harder on your body in that sense. But if you get a real deep sand, which is usually, you know, deeper sands are typical on nice natural beaches, then it's more difficult to jump. But of course, it's a little bit harder on your muscles, but easier on your joints.
This is the season's second event, I think. What is your sense for where things are for you at this point and your hopes for this weekend?
This is the second event. My partner, Theo Bruner, and I took a fifth in the first event about a month ago in Florida. We actually lost our first match, but we came back strong the next day and won our three matches. And then on Sunday, we lost to the top seed, Jake Gibb and Casey Patterson, in three games. And they were close games. We were battling. We were right there. So we're hoping that, you know, hey, you know, we're right there. We know we can beat every single team if we play our best, and that's kind of our goal, is to play our best and end up on top of the podium.
Are you you competed in the 2012 Summer Games? Are you looking ahead to 2016?
No, not much. I mean, a lot of people are, but that's still a solid 2+ years down the road. Theo and I are a new partnership this year. If things really worked out well, and you know, we started doing really, really well on the AVP tour as well as the international tour, then I would, you know, consider it for next year. But right now, you know, I have had a great two Olympics. I was a little disappointed in London taking a ninth, but is what it is. We didn't play our best there. And, you know, if I go to Rio, awesome. If not, it's not going to be the end of the world. I'm kind of just more looking at taking each tournament, seeing how the body's holding up and seeing how the new partnership's going and going from there.
Well, Todd Rogers, best of luck, and we will see you out at Bradford Beach.
Looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
Todd Rogers will compete this weekend at the AVP Milwaukee Open Pro Beach Volleyball Tournament at Bradford Beach. Qualifying rounds run through the day today. The main draw events are Friday through Sunday, and general admission to the tournament is free. If music is more your thing this weekend, Summerfest is not your only opportunity. You also have several chances to catch the distinctive sounds of a brass band in town. One of those chances happens to be after this break on Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Throughout most of the country, funerals are a somber time, a time of grieving for family members mourning the loss of a loved one. New Orleans is kind of an exception. They celebrate the life of the loved one, often accompanied by loud brass instruments playing down the street. Milwaukee's own Stubby Chubbs Brass Band has taken that New Orleans tradition and fused it with traditional songs and their own arrangements of popular songs. They joined Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson in our studio for a conversation and performed a few songs, including this one called I Got a New Baby.
I got a new baby. I got a new baby. I got a new girl. I finally got a peace of mind. I got a new baby. And she drives me crazy. Well, I got a new girl. Finally got a peace of mind. Oh, she's sweet. She's fine. Most definitely one of a kind. She's lovely, she's sexy, and the best part is she's mine. I got a new baby. I got a new baby. I got a new girl. Finally got a piece of mine.
Stubby Chubbs, welcome to WUWM.
Yeah, thanks for having
us. Hi. Yeah. Our pleasure.
Who or what is Stubby Chubbs?
Well, it's a brass band, of course. No, the name comes from, I'd gotten most of these guys together and a few others that aren't here, and we wanted to form a little band, and so I thought the best way to just communicate and stay in touch was just to make a little Facebook group. So I made it that night, and I didn't know what to call it, and those were the first two words that came to mind. Unfortunately, it's nothing more epic than that. It's about it.
You guys play a random assortment of band instruments, kind of like, oh, you got the trumpet, you got the trombone, percussion, sousaphone, and saxophone. It kind of looks like you are a kind of a glorified pep band that plays jazz music and pop tunes. So how do you define your group? Like, what do you guys play?
Well, yeah, we kind of take some influence from the New Orleans brass band down in Louisiana, which, you know, plays parades, funeral marches, obviously during Jazz Fest and all the big festivals down there. But I think that's where the instrumentation sort of influence comes from, and a lot of our songs do as well.
Yeah, definitely a strong tradition. Like, we definitely didn't invent this sort of thing by any means. But as far as, like, the tunes we play, yeah, we kind of, because Crystal here has been in other sorts of groups like that, and she's more familiar with that sort of style, so she kind of got us started with that stuff. And then we kind of just made other things our own to fit that sort of style, like grab some pop tunes. Like we do some everything from Michael Jackson to Justin Timberlake.
To Seal.
Yeah.
Anything we like playing, pretty much.
Right,
if we think,
really.
Hey, we could probably play that, and we could probably play it well. So
it all depends on the mood of the day.
Yeah.
On your website, it says that you are kind of like what Chris was saying about how you emulate the New Orleans jazz band funeral marches, but second line. What is the difference between first line and second line?
Well, second line just comes from, they were like the second line of the parades and whatnot. That's kind of where that term comes from.
Do they do anything different musically?
They move around.
They move around.
Yeah,
that was a big one.
In terms of like, say, funeral marches, or often people attending would follow the coffin, the hearse, whatever, would go out into the streets and would parade around, you know, the cliche umbrellas. And it's celebration of somebody's life, and oftentimes there is a band there to help parade down to, you know, where they were going to bury the body. And that's sort of how the second line came to be. And a lot of influence. I mean, you go down there, there's 13-year-old kids playing, getting brass bands together and just playing the snot out of their instruments.
Trombone shorty.
So, you know, that's how the second line sort of came into play. And it creates a really nice group of instruments that can do a lot of really flexible things.
Yeah.
It seems like you guys are a lively group. Is that kind of an understatement?
That's a nice way to
put it. Yeah, that's what the people that like us say.
You have a real swinging beat. Right. Have you guys been to New Orleans at all?
I haven't. I want to someday. Someday.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's on the bucket list,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I know when I went down there a couple of years ago, it was this, you know, not life-changing, but, you know, it's definitely influential. I went down there during Oktoberfest, and it's just music everywhere. I mean, if I had that much talent in my little pinky, I would have
it. Yeah, you'd grow your pinky back?
How long have you guys been playing for?
As a group?
Yeah, as a group.
A little over a year.
Yeah. Definitely over a year, because I remember our first actual show, our first gig was like Mardi Gras, 2013.
Our first paid gig was Ash Wednesday.
We didn't get paid?
Oh, that was fun.
No, we didn't get paid.
Maybe we didn't.
I don't think we got paid.
Do we get paid now?
I'll check the chub fund.
It's the love of the tradition, right?
Yeah, it's the love of the music. But yeah, so we've been playing gigs for a little over a year, and then we started. Really, it was just trying to get the right members. We kind of went through a couple different formations at the beginning, and then, you know, found these guys and gal, and it clicked, and we'd been rehearsing since, I guess, what year are we in? 2014? Late 2012 is when we first started rehearsing, I guess.
Because you guys are all from University of Wisconsin Milwaukee, correct?
That's where we met. Yeah, except. That guy.
Really
sorry. Ben. Yep. Ben Hohenstein on the tenor sax is not. Our latest addition. Our latest addition.
Point with your words, Nick.
But yeah, everyone else is a UWM grad or current student.
Have you guys ever played at funerals?
Not yet.
I've played a funeral, not with Stubby Chubs, though. Okay. I actually subbed in with Extra Crispy Brass Band. Played a funeral with them. It was really special. It was something that I hope we get to do because it was really cool.
If I die anytime soon, I hope you guys will come there. I mean, because I won't. Dermot is a little sick.
Oh, drank good whiskey tonight. Oh, it hurts to see her there, lying out so cold, so white. Well, she's gone.
Guys, play any traditional New Orleans funeral music? Are you doing mostly pop tunes, pep band songs? How do you arrange music?
Yes.
I'll say our selection process is erratic.
Yeah.
it's really what we feel like we don't have a balance of. So, for instance, when we were picking out some of the Michael Jackson tunes, we figured we could take, you know, one of these really popular tunes and then put it into the style like it has been already done before, but we figured it would be something that we could do and easily put together and make sound good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the tunes we played here were all traditional. What did we play? Yeah. So all those were, you know, some traditional tunes that you probably hear down in the New Orleans.
Yeah, because I heard some that could kind of leak over into blues in
yeah.
a way.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely all related for sure. But yeah, like St. James is one of the oldest tunes in the book, as far as I know. And people have done just hundreds of different versions of that one. But, yeah, and then we also have, like we said earlier, we'll just kind of take some tunes we like and just play them. Basically, our arranging process is sit in a room and figure out what to do. And then
do it. And if it doesn't work, then stop doing it.
Yeah. Which we've definitely had our fair share of those, too. Yeah. Like, well, we played this tune once or twice. Okay, we learned our lesson.
Looking at you, Shining Star.
Yeah, I still like that one. It gets me.
Because even though the listeners can't see, but when we were recording the music, you guys were pointing all over the place, cueing when to play. Is it changing each time you play? Is it you're improvising as you go? How does this work?
Yes. Yeah. All of the above. It's always changing. We never play the same tune the same way, where it's usually, you know, we'll play certain parts earlier or later, or we're all tired and we point at the drums for a drum solo because we don't want to play again. Or we point at the drums for a drum solo because we don't know what we want to play next.
Or they just sound good sometimes.
Or that too.
Yeah, but they always sound good. That's why we point to them. Yeah, it's always changing, and improvisatory elements are everywhere in our playing, so it's the easiest way to communicate.
Because that stems from the jazz tradition of improvising.
Mm-hmm. Yep, just do it on the fly.
Yeah, this is very much chamber music in some way, shape, or form, where we have to communicate with each other because there's no person conducting. It's all very organic.
And that's probably one of my favorite things about it, is it's just, you know, we're kind of going with the mood. If something's working that night and we're really feeling it, like, do it again. You know what I mean? Just keep going with it.
What do you bring to Milwaukee with the Stubby Chubbs Brass Band? What are you feeling? What void are you feeling that Milwaukee doesn't have?
It doesn't have a very large New Orleans brass band representation, other than our kind of buddy band, I don't know, Extra Crispy Brass Band, who's been around longer than we have. And I don't know that we came to be because of them, but compared to, say, Madison, Milwaukee has a very eclectic scene and can be very limiting depending on where you play. And I think there's a kind of an untapped market for more live music that really interacts with the crowd and is mobile. It's not just we park it on, you know, park and bark. We don't park it on stage and just play at people listening to us. You know, we want to have fun just as much as the crowd does. So we really feed off of that. Does anybody else have anything else to?
Well, I was going
to
say, I think the reason that we originally started was because we were looking for a personal void to fill, right?
With all the Western music we play?
Yeah, we're all classically trained. We've all been to music school, and it's all, you know, it's rigid classical music, and we were looking for something that could be a little more loose, a little more free. So we started this group, and we kind of eventually fell into that void that we're currently filling, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I just,
way to say it.
I just want to have fun when I go to a Chubb gig, you know. And I think that's what comes across, you know. We're hanging out with the audience. We're having a beer with them, you know, just people. We love to invite people to come up and sit in with us, whether it's someone that's been, you know, playing this sort of genre, like the Extra Crispy guys will sometimes come in, and like, especially our Andy Book. But sometimes it's people who maybe don't play in front of crowds a lot and just need a little shove out there, and you know, and they love it too. So and that's what I love, just, you know, bringing other people up and playing for people that just really seem to enjoy it and get something out of it. I'll still never forget the time we were at the Uptowner, and there was a woman there who her husband kept trying to get her up there to sing with us. We were playing, you know, Saints or whatnot. And she was all really timid and looking scared. And then as soon as she opened her mouth, it was this beautiful, beautiful, just low alto voice. And it was she sounded great. And would have never known that if she didn't just go up and do it. So
you're a very personable band then.
Oh, yeah.
I'd say so.
And you also collaborate with other bands too, like Grasping at Straws, I believe I saw.
Yeah, we play some stuff with them. Yeah, that's what I think is interesting. I noticed we play a lot of shows with like folk bands or like indie alternative bands. It's cool because they don't sound like us and we don't sound like them in any way, shape, or form, but the crowd seems to dig us both, and yeah, it's just a kind of meeting of minds, and we're all musicians sort of thing. So.
And it's also kind of a fusion as well of different folk traditions from America.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just such a diverse country itself.
Absolutely. And the nice thing is some of the tunes will even cross paths, like what's the tune we always play with the Janes?
I'll Fly Away.
Thank you. Yeah.
Didn't we collab it with the Janes on that once?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the Climbing Janes. Yeah. I don't know. We're collaborating left and right.
Collaborating.
Where can we hear you guys play around town?
The place that we've definitely played the most gigs. We've done the most at the Uptowner. We had a monthly show there for a bit. Discontinued that just because, you know, band people moving around and whatnot with graduation. But I think I'm hoping you'll be able to hear us there July 4th. We're starting the morning off. We're doing a little parade down by the domes. I think that's where it ends. Yeah. Well, July 4th morning there, and then that evening we're hoping to play at the Uptowner and party there till the break of dawn, till July 5th.
Awesome. Well, Stubby Chubbs Brass Band, thank you so much for being at WWM.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Our pleasure.
Stubby Chubbs Brass Band is a local group made up of graduates from UW-Milwaukee. They spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson. The band will play tonight at Milwaukee's Bremen Cafe and tomorrow outside the Uptowner for a concert that's set to run from 8 p.m. until it is over. Tomorrow, of course, is the 4th of July, and we'll be making way for the Capitol Steps Politics Takes a Holiday special. I'm Mitch Tyke. Hope you have some time to enjoy the Independence Day weekend, no matter what you do. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.